This is Martha Burke with KSFR's Equal Time. Today I'm talking with Melanie Stansberry, one of several Democratic candidates for the U.S. House in New Mexico's Congressional District 1. The district serves central New Mexico, including Torrance County, parts of Sandoval, Santa Fe, and Valencia counties, most of Bernalillo County, and almost three-quarters of Albuquerque. Candidates are running to fill the seat formerly occupied by Deborah Hallen, recently confirmed as U.S. Secretary of the Interior. Representative Melanie Stansberry is a native New Mexican and state legislator representing New Mexico House District 28 on the east side of Albuquerque. Stansberry has worked in communities across the state as an educator and researcher on land and water issues. She served as a former staffer in the U.S. Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources and the White House Office on Management and Budget. Welcome, Melanie Stansberry.
Hi, good morning. It's wonderful to be here this morning.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start with just the basics of the election here because it's not what we normally know as an election where each party has a primary, people run against one another, and whoever is victorious then runs against the other party in the general election. This year it's going to be different. Can you tell our listeners exactly what this strange election is going to be like?
Yeah, well, it is a very complicated election. So kind of at the highest level, once our amazing Congresswoman, Deb Holland, became confirmed as our next Interior Secretary, it triggered a special election. And our special election rules are set by the Secretary of State rather than in statute. And so shortly after Deb Holland was confirmed, our Secretary of State called the special election and announced that it would be held on June 1st. And so pursuant to those rules, each of the major parties chooses their nominee. So the Republican Party is actually choosing their nominee tomorrow, and the Democratic Party is choosing their nominee starting on Tuesday. And I can't really speak to the Republican process, but at least in the Democratic Party, the way that it's being done is by the State Central Committee, which is individuals who are elected at the grassroots level in their wards and precincts across CD1 and comprise the governing body of our party. So on Tuesday, about 200 people are going to cast their ballot for their nominee, and there's 8 candidates in this race. And we'll do multiple rounds of voting until somebody gets over 50%.
So the way it works is the delegates are chosen by the various precincts around the district. Then they vote on one of several candidates. And if no one gets it, is it a 51% majority?
Well, yeah, anything over 50%.
Okay, so if no one gets that, are they free in the next round, if you will, to cast their ballot for someone else, or how does that work?
Yeah, so in the next round, it's basically, in the first round, as I understand it, you cast your ballot for your first choice. You know, we'll take the top percentage of people that add up to 50%, and then those people will run off in the next round, and those SEC and caucus voters can cast their ballot for whoever they like in the second round.
I see. So basically the party is going to pick the main candidate, and then that candidate will go to a general election against a Republican, correct?
Exactly, yes. And there's also a Libertarian in the race as well.
I see. All right. Should be interesting.
Yeah. As I said
in the intro, you are currently a member of the New Mexico State Legislature. You represent District 28 on the east side of Albuquerque. What made you decide to give that seat up and run for the U.S. Congress?
Oh, well, that is such a good question. So my background is, and I've always worked kind of at the nexus between science, sustainability, and social justice. And I was born and raised right here in New Mexico. And my work, my entire career, has really been kind of around issues around land and water rights issues, restorative justice, community development, and anti-poverty work. And so Throughout my career, I've worked on these issues in different ways as an educator, as a researcher. I currently have a consulting practice where I work with philanthropy and research and nonprofit organizations. But I was lucky enough to work in Washington, D.C. for about 7 years. I worked in the White House Office of Management and Budget during the Obama administration, and I worked in the United States Senate in the Energy Committee. And when I moved home in 2017, I did the Emerge program, which is a women's leadership program, and a number of people encouraged me to run for office. And, you know, I had always been the staffer, the person who sat behind the person who was the, you know, the leader, politician. But what sort of originally inspired me to run myself was very much what happened in the 2016 election. And, you know, tens of thousands of women stepped up to run for office in the 2018 cycle because of that. But I saw it as a way to really extend the work that I had done my entire life around anti-poverty and environmental issues. And so I ran for the State House for those reasons, and the legislation that I've worked on includes climate change and hunger issues and water issues. And so when it was looking like Deb would be the nominee, a number of people who had worked with me legislatively and on my campaigns asked if I would consider running for the seat. And I said yes because, well, I know what the job is and I know what's entailed in it. But I really see it as an opportunity to further the work that I've spent my life doing, to lift up, you know, the voices of people in our community, to work on food and hunger issues, but with more resources, to really tackle homelessness with federal resources. And the work that I do, my daily work is really focused on climate change and water resilience. And so I think that I have a unique skill set. And as a New Mexican, you know, really understand our communities and the opportunity to help take that experience I have in Washington and at the state level to help bring resources home and help really lift up our communities and support the work that our communities want to do to help advance all the things that we have to do around education, social justice, economic equality, climate change, all those things.
Well, when we talk about, and you did mention, of course, a couple of times, energy, which is a very big issue here in New Mexico, and the oil and gas folks are a little bit worried right now because it is a main source of revenue for the state. There is a lot of angst, if you will, around climate change and the effect on the environment of both oil and gas. How do you plan to handle that in a state that depends on those resources for revenue?
Yeah, well, this last session, I helped sponsor a bill. It was House Bill 9 that was very much focused on how do we rethink this transition as we are trying to fight climate change, but also secure our economy, make sure that people have good, affirming, good paying jobs, and that we're able to stabilize our economy. And so I think you have to tackle climate change really from three perspectives. You know, there's the obvious, you know, just basic chemistry of climate change, which is that we have to address carbon going into the atmosphere. And so I think that it's really important that we do that as an all of the above approach of the economy, of trying to address it across all sectors, but also to improve carbon sequestration through reforestation and things like that. I think the second piece of addressing climate change is really addressing the resilience aspects of it. You know, I work a lot on water here in New Mexico, and I work a lot with hydrologists and climate scientists. And the science is telling us that climate change is already here. And in fact, much of the drought and variability we've seen in the last several decades is due to climate change. And so we really need to prepare science tools, resources, technical assistance for our communities, for farmers, for natural resources managers to be able to manage a changing landscape. And the third aspect of, you know, this big transition is to really rethink our economy. And, you know, here in New Mexico, our people are so resilient and creative and have lived in this land for generations and generations. And so I think that one of the most powerful things that we can do is really center our communities in that conversation and provide resources and tools for communities to really do thoughtful long-term economic planning. Because I think a lot of the conversation gets reduced down to, well, we'll just replace fossil fuel jobs with clean energy jobs. And the truth is there's not enough clean energy jobs currently to do that. And so we have to be creative and really think about that. And also think about, you know, the fossil fuel industry itself is going to transform and become carbon free probably eventually as well.
And how would you say there will not be enough so-called green jobs to take up the slack if oil and gas goes away or substantially goes away? What would you do for some of those workers that might be displaced almost on a permanent basis?
Well, I want to clarify, I think that eventually there will be, the sky is the limit in terms of green jobs and green job opportunities. But just the reality of sort of the infrastructure of where our state currently is, it's not like you can flip a switch overnight, right? It's not like we're going to have all wind and solar jobs and everyone who's working on oil rigs is going to move over to that. But the reality is that there are workers that are displaced. And, you know, I mentioned I grew up here. I was actually born in Farmington. And my mother was a machine oiler, machine operator at the San Juan Power Plant. And she was a good union paid worker there. And those are the kinds of jobs that will be lost as that power plant is shutting down. And so it's a very real and a very serious issue that, you know, I think that often doesn't get enough attention paid on it as we're talking about the environmental aspects of climate change. And, you know, there are workers that will be displaced, and that is a grave and very serious issue. And the way I think that we have to address it is by providing resources for communities to really reimagine their economic futures and to think about what do we have, you know, what are people inspired to do? What are the resources that are here? What are the economic opportunities that can be built out long term to help replace jobs over the long term?
You're listening to KSFR's Equal Time. I'm Martha Burke, and today I'm talking with Melanie Stansberry, one of several Democratic candidates for the U.S. House in New Mexico's District 1. Let's move to a different topic now, which you've already mentioned, and that is the hunger problem, particularly for kids. We are unfortunately always number one or number two in the nation here in New Mexico in child poverty. And of course, that is part of the hunger issue. It's part of the opportunity issue for our kids and their futures. How would you address those things?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about this because it's actually a true passion. I work on hunger issues quite a lot. We have a food, hunger, and agriculture working group that has been meeting for the last several years, and it includes our food banks and food pantries across the state and local and tribal government organizations, nonprofit advocacy organizations. And the reason why we started convening that work group a couple of years ago was to really look at how do we address the systemic issues around hunger, because like you mentioned, you know, we do have among the highest rates of hunger in the country, and we certainly have the highest and growing rates of hunger among children. And, you know, there's sort of the emergency aspect of how do we make sure that people who are hungry right now can get access to food. And then there's the bigger structural question about why do we have persistent hunger and how do we fix a really broken food system and reconnect our agricultural producers who are growing food back to our communities. Because part of the challenge is that New Mexico actually exports over 90% of its agricultural products and imports over 90% of its food. And so the food system itself is really broken.
That is something that I think most people probably don't know. It is an astounding little tidbit there that we export a lot of our food and then we have to bring it back in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the things that you don't hear a lot about if you don't work in this area is that actually a lot of it has to do with what I call food infrastructure. So, for example, if you are a rancher here in New Mexico, there's no inspection and slaughterhouses left in the state of New Mexico for distribution in New Mexico. So you have to actually sell your cattle out of state and have the meat butchered and then brought back in if you want to sell in state. So there's really just basic infrastructure issues. You know, we have huge food deserts in New Mexico, especially in rural areas and tribal areas. And a lot of that has to do with like a lack of transportation and cold storage infrastructure. So these are things that can actually be addressed with sustained resources. We just haven't really had a coordinated response. And this last legislative session, we introduced a comprehensive hunger and ag bill. And though the bill did not pass, we were able to get money put into the budget to actually get the work going. So we're hoping that this year, working with the state government and this huge coalition, that we'll be able to help come up with a really comprehensive plan on how to address hunger this year.
Well, moving to another aspect of the hunger problem, of course, is low wages. We are a very low wage state. The Rescue and Recovery Act that recently passed had in it a raise in the minimum wage gradually to $15 an hour nationally. That didn't make it into the final federal bill. How do you feel about our low minimum wage as a member of the United States House, should you be elected? How would you address it?
Well, I think it's a travesty that the $15 minimum wage did not make it into the recovery plan. You know, it's interesting. We just wrapped up our 60-day legislative session, and one of the biggest and most important bills that passed this session was paid sick leave. And a lot of the discussion that happened in the legislature was around, you know, how do we protect workers' rights and shore up our economy at the same time that businesses are recovering from the pandemic. And my perspective on this is that we can't afford not to, you know. Our people thrive when they have a living wage, when they have, you know, supports in the workplace, when they're protected, when they have good paying jobs that are meaningful. So I'm very much a proponent not only of the $15 minimum wage, but really a living wage, because what we know is that $15 isn't even enough of a living wage. I think we really need to focus on passing a federal minimum wage and working with our businesses to make it a reality so that people can have dignified lives.
Well, you mentioned the COVID crisis, of course, which is part and parcel of all of the problems of the poor. And the poor in this country, as we know, are primarily female. And the COVID crisis has been particularly hard on women who have lost most of the jobs that have been lost. Part of that is because there's no daycare. And thanks to the pay gap in a two-earner family, if somebody has to drop out to care for the kids because they can't go to school or there's no daycare, it's going to be the lower earner, and that's a woman, of course. And then the single-parent families, particularly women of color, may have to go on public assistance because there's not another earner in the household. So they may have to go on Medicaid and food stamps. How would you address the problems that have been created particularly for women in this COVID crisis?
Yeah, well, I mean, all of these things are so intertwined, you know, structurally with like the history of women and women's access to the economy and workforce, of course. And so they're all tied to advance women's economic empowerment and addressing the disproportionate impacts that women bear when the economy downturns, right? So, you know, some of the things that are really critical, I think you pointed out in your question, which is that, you know, we've seen the largest job losses during COVID among women, and especially women of color, primarily due to childcare. And so I think, you know, one of the things we need to do is get our schools open back up. And I know a lot of schools in New Mexico are going back in person after after spring break here. And it's difficult, right? Because we need to make sure that all of our teachers and our school workers are fully vaccinated and that schools have the resources to open safely. But, you know, one of the biggest issues is that people have not had childcare. And so kids have been at home and women have been the primary caretakers, remain the primary caretakers in many homes. So I think that getting kids back to school is a really important thing. I think that ensuring that we have programs that support early childhood education and care services, one of the big victories of our legislative session that just wrapped up is we passed HJR1, which hopefully will go to the voters next year to approve permanent funding for early childhood education and care programs. And there's, of course, some funding in the recovery package for that. But also, you know, it's this longer term work of addressing the pay gap, of helping build a greater ladder for women into leadership and greater job and economic security, and all of the kind of constellation of economic things that we know we need to do to support low-income people. And I grew up in a low-income household with a single mother myself, and I'm a working woman, and I've always had to support myself as well. And, you know, the safety net to help families thrive and survive is critical to helping lift people up and getting on their paths.
To drill down a little bit more on the daycare situation as opposed to schools being closed, how mm-hmm. would you feel as a member of the United States Congress about pushing for a true national solution, as many advanced countries in Europe have, almost all of them, have some mm-hmm. kind of state-sponsored daycare or childcare preschool? Would you support something like that in the U.S. Congress?
Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, there's communities in the United States that have already moved that way, including in Washington, D.C. They have universal pre-K. And, you know, the data have borne out that when you move to that model, not only is it good for kids and their, you know, educational and social and emotional health, but more women enter the workforce and there's more economic activity. So it's a win-win-win. So yes, absolutely.
Well, in terms of your being able to function in Washington, as we all know, the Congress is pretty well divided right now. The House does have a narrow majority. If you're elected, mm-hmm. it will retain at least part of that majority, replacing Representative Hallen, who's now Interior Secretary. But with such a narrow division, it's going to be pretty hard to get things done. How could you mm-hmm. reach across the aisle in the House to your Republican colleagues? And going further than that, what do you think about abolishing the filibuster, which is very much on the national mind right now?
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, well, I am very much for abolishing the filibuster. I think there's no question that for decades and generations, you know, really critical legislation has been blocked by the filibuster, including civil rights legislation and really critical progressive legislation that we've been trying to pass the last several years and decades. So I'm for abolishing the filibuster. You know, I used to work in the U.S. Senate. Like I said, I was a committee staffer in the Senate Energy Committee. And it was during that work, working on the Hill, that I really learned the art and the craft of how do you draft a bill? How do you get a bill through the process? How do you get it included as part of a package, a bipartisan package that can ultimately be passed? And, you know, there's very few bills in this day and age that actually run through Congress as a standalone bill. Almost all bills that move through Congress are big packages. And all of those packages tend to be bipartisan packages at the end of the day. So I think that having had a background of working on the Hill and knowing the process and the players and having negotiated and put together those packages, I have a unique skill set in this race and this campaign to really understand how you put together meaningful legislation and get it across the finish line. And, you know, that's the skills I've taken to the state level. Almost all of the legislation I do is bipartisan, even though I don't have to, because I think it's just good government and the best way to do things.
That has to be the last word. Thank you so much, candidate Melanie Stansberry for New Mexico's Congressional District 1.
Well, thank you so much for having me on this morning. It was wonderful talking to you.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure having you, and good luck with the election, which comes up tomorrow. For KSFR's Equal Time, I'm Martha Burke.